That episode was a whirlwind.
Yeah, we just recorded with our buddy Will O'Brien. This episode was like my favorite conversations living in San Francisco, where you run into a weirdo who knows a lot about something you know very little about, and you get way smart. In like 45 minutes, your mind gets blown like five times, and you just get smarter. So this is a get smarter episode for me.
And it wasn't just about like the business and the ideas that he talked about, but the mindset and how he thought about just like the philosophy of life that I was inspired by.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about how the ocean is the new space, how there's companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, all these companies that are doing cool shit in space. He knows a lot about companies that are doing cool things in the ocean, which is something I honestly didn't know anything about going in. Now I'm pretty fascinated with. But then we talked about the conversation toward the end gets really fun. Conspiracy theories, why conspiracy theorists make for great founders, his summer living with monks in Nepal, and what he took out of that. It was, the end is really good. So get there to the end. I promise you, you will enjoy this episode. I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel. Never. All right, what's up? Back. We got our friend Will O'Brien here, and Will is an Irish guy who talks my ear off about the ocean. And I honestly wasn't thinking about the ocean at all until I saw maybe a tweet of yours, which was basically saying the ocean is the new space, and how there's companies like SpaceX and others that have built huge $100 billion plus companies about exploring space, about putting satellites in space, about reusable rockets, and that there's an opportunity for a similar wave of disruption for startups in the ocean. And I love that idea. Honestly, I'm never going to do it. So I'll just put that up front. I'm never going to do something like that. I think 99.9% of people listening to this will also never go do that thing. But just from a, I don't know, just as a fan of the game, just as a founder, I kind of love the theory and the intellectual idea here of what is the opportunity. And then if you're one of the rare few hardcore founders that can go do this, you know, this is going to be right up your alley. So that's my interest in it. Sam, I'm curious from your perspective, are you the same as me?
Dude, I won't even go on a cruise ship. Like I was at a party the other day, and the one-liner or the icebreaker was what something you're deathly afraid of. To me, it's being in the ocean to where I can't see land. So like I'm not even going to be out there. But yeah, I agree with your premise.
And Will, did I kind of frame your argument right as to like the potential that you see as far as, you know, the business opportunity of building startups that are focused on the ocean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the framing is like, you know, something like this. It's like, you know, everyone is like here standing on Earth, like looking towards the stars, and absolutely we should be doing that, and we should be going like, you know, full pelt with like trying to go interplanetary, trying to put a base on the moon and take the dark side of the moon, and then, you know, go from there and use that as a landing point to go to Mars. And we should be trying to fly supersonic as well. But then look, if you're trying to build a startup, like you're always asking yourself like, where, you know, what is everyone else looking to do, and like where is everyone else going, and where is like underrated. And I suppose, you know, I grew up by the seaside and like in the southwest of Ireland. I've always been obsessed with the ocean. If I wasn't like on it, in it, or near it growing up, there was something wrong. In the same way that you're afraid, Sam, of it. I'm kind of like, when I'm away from it, I feel something wrong with me. So I've always been thinking about it. And I mean, if you just like look at it in like, you know, fundamental terms, like the ocean economy right now is like already massive. It's not like, you know, the future space economy is going to be massive. Like the ocean economy is massive. It's like $3 trillion in like annual spend in different ways, right? It covers like 70% of the planet. 3 billion people rely on it as their primary source of food, 1 billion as their primary source of income. And then, you know, while we have like, you know, robots on Mars and, you know, these like low cost drones going in our skies, the technology like in our oceans like still pales in comparison. Like, you know, you look at like the ships that are out there today, like much of the technology is like very same and similar to like what we had years ago. The unmanned, you know, underwater drones are like, you know, pretty much like the same as well there. Like the kind of key core technology stack supporting like the key pillars of the ocean, whether it be transport, fisheries, defense, energy, you know, biodiversity, all these areas, it's just like it's the same old like stagnant incumbents, large scale incumbents offering solutions that, you know, are running on like ancient software. And there's just like very little innovation going on there. It's like, you know, you ask someone like, what is like a sexy ocean startup? And it's like, they're kind of scratching their heads for a bit, you know, whereas you ask them about space, it's like SpaceX straight away. It's like, you know, it's straight away. It's like you ask them about aerospace, it's like, oh, boom. So yeah, this is like the kind of like the core of the thesis.
Sean, you just wound them up really easily. This is gonna be one of the this is gonna be one of those podcasts that we've had. We've only had maybe five of them ever, where at the end of the hour we are like, we're no longer podcasting. We're getting into the ocean business.
Yeah.
Like,
let's go. So Sam, he's just said a bunch of stats. So which of those surprised you? So I'm just going to rattle a couple back. He said, all right, this one probably doesn't surprise you. 70% of the earth is covered in water. I think only 25% has ever been explored. He said a billion people rely on the ocean for their primary source of income. 3 billion as their diet? Explain that. What's the diet and the jobs one of the income one?
Oh, it's just like people, like, you know, most of, I mean, like, human societies generally settle along coastlines. Like, this is like a very like common trend.
Yeah, but I'm in New York, but I don't eat fish every day.
Yeah, but in developed countries, it's not as, we've developed logistics, which means you can go down the street and walk into some sushi bar and get, like, you know, bluefin tuna probably flew in last night from Japan. However, if you are in, you know, Mogadishu or like Somalia or something like that, this might be a bit more difficult because the systems are not set up. So, and it's important to remember, most of the world does not live in, you know, developed countries. So yeah, most humans just live along a coastline. Naturally, then easiest source of food for them to get is fish.
All right, here's the deal. If HubSpot tripled the price, I'd be screwed. The reason I would be screwed is because my entire company is run on HubSpot.com. My website, my email marketing, my dashboards, how I track my customers, literally everything. And if they tripled the price, I would pay them more money. And that's because the product is so freaking powerful. My entire company is built on it. And so if you're running a business and you want to grow faster, you want to grow better, you want to be more organized, check it out, HubSpot.com. All right, back to the pod. All right. So what were some other stats, Sean, that caught your eye?
A billion people rely on it for their income. So what are the jobs that you're talking about here? So are you talking about fisheries, shipping? Is it like defense? Like, what is that? Are those the big three, or am I missing something big and obvious?
The framing for me, how I think about like the ocean economy, is like you generally kind of break it up into like three categories, right? Like you have like the biosphere, right? Which is like your fisheries, it's your ecosystem restoration, it's like your environmental mapping, it's science in the ocean, it's like all around like biosphere management. Then you have like, you know, the kind of prosperity oriented part around it. This is like the kind of commercial, this is like your energies, your infrastructure, it's your oil and gas, it's your like data infrastructure, you know, these sorts of things. It's your like logistics, shipping. And then you have like, you know, keeping the seas safe, which is like defense and security, border security, critical infrastructure protection, deploying ships in the South China Sea, these sorts of things.
And so give me an example of a startup today that's doing really well, that's based on this kind of ocean economy that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think one player that's like interesting in the unmanned systems space that's been around for a long time, I think over a decade now, and was really kind of one of the first players to start doing interesting new things in the ocean is Saildrone.
What problem are they solving? What does Saildrone do?
I suppose they are solving the kind of data gathering at scale in the ocean problem. They build these like autonomous sailboats, these huge vessels.
They look amazing. Yeah. They look awesome.
They build these like huge vessels these massive sailboats that can basically stay at sea for many, many months at a time. You can put a load of, you know, fancy sensors on them, you know, that can take data from the water, that can, you know, gather video footage at the surface and these sorts of things, and then relay them back to someone like in the United States. It might be like a government agency like NOAA, who want to know how much fish is in the seas off Alaska. They could sell it to the US Navy to know, you know, how deep is the waters in and around Guam or something like that. And then they sell these things as a service. But, you know, they're very interesting founder there. You know, it seems like a super sharp guy who's been obsessed with sailing for decades. Again, like a lot of these ocean founders that you see, they're very, very obsessed with the ocean. It's the very thing people very often get obsessed about and then try to make a business out of it.
What's your business do, Will? What's Ulysses or Ulysses?
Ulysses. How do you say? Yeah. Ulysses. Ulysses, we're building a general purpose autonomy platform for maritime operations.
Say that like we're stupid.
Just like, just pretend. Pretend that we're stupid.
Yeah. I know it's hard to believe, but just go ahead and dumb that down for me.
Autonomous robots for the ocean to do important things.
Okay. And what's one important thing that you would do? You would, like, for example, you would go to a pipe in the ocean and determine if it's got a hole in it?
That is something you could do. Our first business line has been working with this weird plant that you've probably never heard of. There's this plant in the ocean that's probably about 10 times more abundant than coral reefs. It is 35 times better than rainforest at removing carbon. It supports it holds about 20% of the carbon in the ocean, supports about a quarter of the world's most critically important fish stocks, and it's called seagrass. It's basically just grass in the ocean. And this plant is dying off at an insane rate all around the world, about 7% loss per annum. If you follow these trends, we lose all our
7% a year of this thing is going away. Okay.
And why is it dying? Is it because pollution or what's the cause?
There's a few things. I mean, water quality is like a very common, cause for loss. Other things are just like construction around like coastlines, digging it up, dredging, changing ocean temperatures, changing like ocean currents, these sorts of things impact it. And basically, you know, the kind of context there is there's a lot of governments in around all over the world, like really, really panicking around this. Like if they lose their seagrasses, they lose their fish stocks. If they lose their fish stocks, you have the 1 billion people who rely on it and 3 billion people who rely on it for food and the billion for income. And, you know, they're in a tough situation. And basically restoring it, i.e. bringing it back, is currently a very manual process.
And how are you guys doing that?
We built autonomous robots to do it.
And you're actually building the robots yourself? Or when you said you're building a platform, I thought that meant you're allowing other people to build it and use your technology to like track them.
Yeah. So for this first use case, we've built a kind of custom robotic payload. You know, like when you're starting and trying to do something new, it's kind of important to kind of get, you know, initial traction in a weird place. And I think if we just built something and hoped that people would use it for something, if we just built the platform, which is like an underwater vehicle and a surface vehicle that dock together, you know, we might have trouble getting traction. But we started off with this initial use case. We basically built these like attachments that go onto our underwater vehicle that do collecting seeds, planting seeds, measuring their growth to kind of get this initial traction. So, you know, in our first year, we did $1 million in revenue, just kind of like 12, you know, for first year, five-person team based here in San Francisco.
Why would someone pay you to do this?
So the reason people pay us is because it's, you know, it's a critically important like ocean ecosystem that, you know, if lost, has these like very negative downstream impacts. Yeah, that's like, you know, one reason. Another reason is like lots of governments now around the world have implemented laws that restrict your ability to damage this plant. If you damage it, you have to pay someone to plant it. So they're paying us to plant it. It's compliance-driven restoration. So that's the kind of contract. We have a contract in Western Australia. We have a contract in Florida. We have a contract in Virginia. And they're all kind of for like these general reasons, either compliance-driven restoration or voluntary-led restoration.
Sam, I put, how important is seagrass into ChatGPT? Here's what I said. Seagrass is wildly important to the world. And then it basically says it captures carbon 35 times faster than rainforest, which I think he said. And then it says, it's like a baby crib for the ocean. The seagrass basically is where small fish, crabs, seahorses, and even endangered species and turtles, they're born and they live early on in their life. And if lost, then you would, it says, lose the seagrass and entire marine ecosystems collapse.
Yeah.
Well, what's crazy is, the mission check, like on board, amazing. You kind of skipped the headline, Sean. He built a robotics business that in the first year, you said you only raised $2 million or something like that. So with only $2 million in funding, in your first 18 months of business, you did $1 million in revenue. Is that right?
Yeah. And just five people as well.
Is there something new about building like a robotics company today that lets you do it way cheaper? Like, did something change? Like, oh, we all use whatever, you know, it's like when the Raspberry Pi came out, then it's like, oh, we can now have this little computer for $35 or whatever. Is there something that's made it a lot cheaper, or maybe just there's more talent? What's changed?
3D printers has been huge. Like, that's just like a game changer. It means just like the speed of iteration has gone up massively. It's, you know, it's easier now to get parts overnight as well, and just like get like sheet metal cut, and the cost of a lot of things has gone down like massively as well, like with like the advent of like electric vehicles, batteries kind of went down massively, and a lot of electronic components with drones, the motors went down massively in cost. You know, for us as well, like a critical enabler of what we do, right, is Starlink, because, you know, the way our system works is like we have this like autonomous boat. It's like a surface vehicle. This is like our mothership. And then we have a docking system that releases these daughter robots, these like autonomous underwater vehicles to do the actual critical activity in the ocean that you want to do. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to communicate with these assets without something like Starlink. You had Iridium before, but like the bandwidth on that wasn't that strong. And so you have like other like kind of why now features like that.
And that company you were talking about, Saildrone, they've raised like over $100 million. It looks like they're valued $500 to $1 billion. That's interesting. There's another one called Saronic. Sam, do you know Saronic?
No. How do you spell it?
S-A-R-O-N-I-C. And Will, you probably know a little bit more about this company than me. I think this Joe Lonsdale seeded this company, right?
Yes. Yeah.
God, this looks sick as well.
So like yeah, when we had Joe on the podcast and I was at his house, he was telling me about this company. Should have just invested on the spot. But he was basically like, we're building drones for the water. Yeah. And, you know, drones in the for defense, just like Anduril's doing it for the sky. And you know, modern warfare has turned into to drone-based. They're building these unmanned surface vehicles, USVs, for the ocean. And they talked about how, did you know this? Like the U.S. Navy, Sam, just take a guess. How many ships are in the U.S. Navy fleet? Just what's a number?
Oh, I don't know. 500? It's hard to even say. 100?
So, okay, so you're a lot closer than I thought. I would have guessed that we have thousands of ships. We have 300 ships in the Navy.
Is a ship considered like an aircraft carrier? Because those are huge, right? Those are like cities.
Sure.
But, God.
But only 300. That's just like a very small number to me. And we have 67 submarines.
That's it?
67. Dude, I had more kids at my 3-year-old birthday party. That's insane to me. So we got 300 ships or whatever, and basically every ship is like, I don't know the exact cost of it, but let me pull this up. I think they're like, Will, correct me if I'm wrong, but like the average cost of these is something like, or maybe it's the average cost of these contracts, like $250 million every time you get contracted to do one of these. And so you're a startup like Saronic, and you're like, all you have to do is basically say, all right, we're going to come in, we're going to build the most innovative autonomous vehicles here, and we're going to operate, you know, what Anduril did was remarkable. So what Anduril did was in Silicon Valley, the smartest tech people, nobody was working on defense. Google had famously shut down its defense project and defense was taboo. Like you're going to make weapons. That was not cool at the time. And there was basically zero weapons startups in San Francisco. And what they did was they said, we're going to do this. We're going to use the Silicon Valley method and talent to do this. We're going to change the cost structure. So all the big defense primes were operating on what's called cost plus model. And so their incentive really was to have really high cost operations because they were making 10% on top of whatever the cost was, right? So the incentive model is sort of screwed up. And that's how you get, you know, a single airplane that's like $1 billion or something like that to get made. And so it was costing the government a lot. These guys had no incentive to innovate, no incentive to cut costs. And they were using talent that was not the smartest engineering talent in the world, which was all centered in Silicon Valley. And then Anduril comes out, Paul Malecki and Trey and others, they basically came out and what they said was, we believe this is important. We believe that America needs this. And we believe we should put the best talent in the world on this problem. And they've built now a $20 to $30 billion company doing this. And the reason I find this exciting is that I love these huge opportunities that are hidden in plain sight. I talked to a friend recently who knew Elon, and I said, what was Elon like? Were you impressed with Elon? He goes, I was impressed with Elon, but not because he was the smartest guy in the room. You know, we would be at a party, there's 20 people. You couldn't say, oh my God, that's the guy. He goes, but the thing that Elon did better than everybody else was that Elon looked down at the ground and saw a $1 trillion opportunity that was just sitting there. You know, before Elon, it's not like there were a bunch of people trying to build, you know, rocket companies or electric car companies. It wasn't like they were trying and failed and he succeeded. They weren't even trying. And he goes, the beautiful part about Elon is that he saw those and he didn't ignore it like the rest of us. And that idea of let's go to Mars was there. It was available to all of us and we were all blind to it. And so similarly, I think Anduril did that in the defense space. And now it looks like Saronic is basically doing that in the sort of ocean defense space, where, you know, you have this combination of elite talent at robotics and AI and autonomy, and you pair it with this old industry. And I think you have a pretty unique window to build a very big company doing this.
Yeah, like they're building, I think of it like they're building the Humvees and we're building the Toyota Hiluxes, right? Like they're building like these like ultra fast, like defense focused, like vehicles. And like they're, you know, going to make the South China Sea a hellscape and make China not want to cross that, that ocean and keep Taiwan safe if they keep going on the path they're doing. And they're doing like an incredible job at that. And then we occupy like a different niche. Like we're like, we just want like every single like, you know, day-to-day task that is like done at sea, we want it done like on our platform. And so like we want like all the servicing done by like Ulysses platforms and these sorts of things. There's like a lot of things that are making the ocean like very important in this century more than previous ones. Like warfare is a good example. Like every other single war we've fought in the last like three decades until now has been like in a desert, right? Now we're going to the ocean. That requires like a complete retooling of the military, you know, and just even how we think about warfare just fundamentally needs to change. Like the climate question is ultimately an ocean question. Like the ocean is like the world's largest natural carbon sink. It is like where most of the life on Earth lives. It is, you know, one of our biggest sources of like food in a world where like a population is growing and food scarcity is always a question. Even just like you look at AI, right? Like the data infrastructure build out for AI is going to be like enormous, right? And basically that's going to require more data infrastructure, i.e. like cables connecting different parts of the world, transmitting data. We're going to need more data centers. We're going to need more energy. These are all things like we're already putting data centers in the ocean. The cooling costs go down massively. They become like more efficient.
So, well, let's go back. So there's already pipes under the ocean that basically like internet pipes under the ocean, correct?
Yeah. I mean, most of the information that tried our internet connection now is most of that is like traveling underground.
And who built that? Is that the government built that or Google built that? Who put those pipes in the ocean to do that?
So a lot of the initial infrastructure build out for IT in the ocean came from telecoms companies, actually.
Yeah, like in the 80s, Sean, there's a handful of telecom companies that were startups, and they're some of the fastest growing companies in the world. So like imagine the AI companies today that are scaling to 100 million in revenue in a year. That was...
Did they die or what happened to them?
A lot of them are still running. And then there was some of the, you know, if you look at like what are the biggest frauds on Earth, like it's like Bernie Madoff. And then like the third one is actually one of these telecom companies that was laying pipes in the ocean. But a lot of them are still around. They're just like small they're B2B companies that you wouldn't even know, but they can be like a $10 billion a year company. But in the 80s, right? Well, I don't know if you know this, but in the 80s, that was like the birth of a lot of this, wasn't it?
Yeah, massively. And now you're seeing a transition to the build out being coming from FANG, from like big tech. And soon I think it'll be like the AI companies.
So what you're saying, Will, now is that AI companies need these data centers, just huge amounts of GPUs in a data center. And those data centers need cooling, they need power, they need tons of things. And they need to be close to places where people are using it. And what you're saying is that somebody's going to build a data center in the ocean, or people are already building data centers in the ocean. And who's doing that? Or is this a future idea? And why are they doing that? Why is that a good idea?
Yeah. So I think the first experiment of this was a Microsoft project. They did it. There's a YC startup as well, run by friends of mine, Sam Mendel. He's got a company called Network Ocean. They're building and operating, starting to building and operate these things.
Are they actually underwater or are they on top of the water, just out in the ocean?
The plan is for it to be subsea. And again, like these are the sorts of businesses that like Ulysses, we want to be the kind of servicing partner for in the future. When they need maintenance, when they need like inspections done, when they like, it's like us they're coming to and we're selling them like a kind of in the box solution to it. I think the biggest opportunity in this like, you know, paradigm in the future where more and more data cables are being laid subsea is actually in the protection of them. Right. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with what's going on in like the Baltic Sea and places, but like I think in the last year, about 11 cables have been cut by foreign actors. And like, you know, basically the kind of.
And these cables, by the way, they're like, it's like a human sized tunnel, right?
Are they on the ocean floor or are they like floating in the ocean?
Like Wi-Fi? To say cable, we're not talking like a rope that you're pulling. It's like a tunnel, right?
Yeah. And like, okay, like literally the Chinese are literally publicly advertising these cutters that they have, these cable cutters, right? They're literally putting in the South China Morning Press, China unveils powerful deep sea cable cutter could reset the world order. They're not even fucking hiding this. Like they're cutting the cables. They're like, yeah, we're just, look how big our cable cutter is. Like this is just like the new paradigm. And then like, you know, they send these like little like, you know, Taiwanese ships into the, or these Chinese ships into the Baltic Sea on like fishing missions, right? Like what the hell are they doing in the Baltic Sea on fishing missions? Like they're clearly just cutting cables, and then like 2 days later, oh, cable cut.
I wonder. Dude, calling this a cable cutter is like calling a rowboat a ship. You know what I mean? Like maybe technically it's correct, but they need to rebrand this because what you're showing us is basically like a huge submarine. You know, like I'm thinking like a clip.
It's not scissors.
Yeah, this is insane.
So they're going down and they're cutting this, and what does that do? Like. Does a country lose internet, or is it just damage it?
Okay, I'll give you this vision, right? So these cables run between like military bases as well, right? And okay, let's say there's like a hot war breaks out in like the South China Sea, right? First target then is going to be like a military base in like the Pacific, somewhere like Guam, right? What if you want to like completely scramble what, you know, their understanding of and situation awareness of what is going on, you are going to be sending these subsea drones down there to go and cut the cables that is giving them like comms, that's giving them energy. And you're going to be like scrambling their airwaves with like, you know, electromagnetic interference. And that's how you're going to like just completely prevent like American military responses in the Pacific, right?
But how many cables, like you're talking to two dummies, how many cables does America rely on?
There's like not actually that many, right? Like as in like there's like an insane amount of data that goes over them, but there's only about like 600 active.
I'm so impressed that you knew that number. That's insane to me. So there's not a lot of redundancy, you're saying?
No, not at all. Like they're very difficult to lay, right? And you need to respond quickly. So yeah, like, I mean, there's like many critical things that rely on them, but like, yeah.
You're way better off defending them with unmanned water drones than trying to lay backup pipes down there and leave them undefended, of course.
You need to be persistently out at sea, like sentry style, in the same way that like Anduril, like have the, you know, started with these like border systems to like see what was coming in and over like the land border. Like we need the exact same type of systems out at sea, like permanently just sitting there on top of them. They need to be cheap so that you can deploy them massively at scale. The ocean is huge, so they need to be cheap to be scalable. You need to be able to see what's going on at the surface, and you need to be able to see what's going on subsurface. And that, fundamentally, that's like the platform that we've developed. We have this like surface vehicle with a docking system that can drop an underwater vehicle, and we've made it like all about 10 times cheaper than anyone else. So like that's, you know, Seagrass is like a nice place where we started.
How deep do your vehicles go? Do they go to like the bottom of the ocean where these pipes are?
So for the Baltic Sea, I mean, it's one of the shallower seas, and this is like the major kind of like area of activity where this is going right now. So our vehicle works in that sea, you know, at all depth profiles in that sea. So for the Baltic Sea part of it, it works. When you get into like gnarlier parts of the ocean, like some of the Pacific, where you're getting down to like 8,000 meters, right, like Mount Everest, you know, levels of depth, we can't go there yet. It just starts getting difficult. But like, yeah, we will be adding future vehicles to the fleet that can.
How old are you, Will?
I'm 27.
Sean, so when you and I moved to San Francisco I moved there in 12 and we're about the same age, it was the sharing economy. That was the thing. So it was Airbnb and Uber and Lyft were the winners. And then there was a bunch of derivative things like Airbnb for garages or for storage. A few years later, it was AI or crypto. So like Bitcoin and Coinbase were winners. And then there was a bunch of like silly things. Right now, this is so strange to me. It's AI, but it's also, well, it's whatever category you guys would go in. You're not quite defense tech, but it's like wild to me that this shift has happened, because 10 years ago, I would have told you, like, you know, that was when Boom Supersonic was starting and a few other things. I would have said, this is foolish. What are you guys doing? We're technology. Right. This is a technology city. Why don't you do like software? It's to hear you say this, it's so foreign to me. It's also so interesting.
Like for me, it's like a no-brainer. I mean, like, you know, the low-hanging fruit of software has been eaten, right? You guys, you, like, you know, it's like,
yeah,
we ate it.
Like, how many more CRMs are there?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the boomers got cheap real estate. You guys got like B2B SaaS, right? Like, it's like, that's like, and now it's like on us to do like something where like the next frontier is, which is like fundamentally hardware. And then like, also it's like a no brainer. You look at like the top 10 most valuable companies in the world right now. It's like 7 out of 10 of them have like a hardware, like an extreme like hardware component, right? Like the biggest companies being built today are hardware companies. And also in a world where you can just like vibe code overnight, like a CRM or a Salesforce, or not maybe not Salesforce, but like a Calendly competitor. It's like, okay, well, is there really a moat in like these sorts of things anymore? It's like,
yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think it's so fascinating because so when Sean and I lived in San Francisco, if someone who looked like you, so you look, you're wearing a Ford Bronco shirt, I bet you're wearing cowboy boots and you got a little bit of swag to you. And you like, if you were to talk about what you're talking about, it would have been like, you're so out of touch. You're out of touch for the YC group of out of touch people. Like, it's just so interesting to me. And I think it's great.
So I did a podcast with James Krueger and he has this thing about technology windows. Sam, did you ever see this part?
No.
About technology windows. So he basically says, all right, there's a reason. There's almost like a scientific reason why what you just described happens. And so he basically says, like, when a wave of startups comes out, it's because of a technology change. So, you know, for example, an inflection. So when you're right, when we first moved to San Francisco, I moved in 2012 and the mobile window was open. And that's when Instagram, Uber, Snapchat, like a bunch of companies got built that relied on you having a computer with you at all times that had internet connection, that had an accelerometer, that had a map, a GPS feature in it. And then all these companies could get built. But that window opens for a very, like a fixed amount of time. And basically, like you said, the low hanging fruit all gets eaten. And so he went back all the way to the railroads and he's like, the railroad technology window was open for 40 years. And if you just look, there was not another successful railroad company after that 40-year period. And because all the opportunities basically got eaten. Automobiles was 25 years. And so in a 25-year window, you got Buick, Dodge, Ford, Cadillac, GM, Chevrolet, Lincoln, Chrysler, all of it within a very short window. And then you had nothing for another about 80 years. And then the window reopened because of battery technology. And you got Tesla and Rivian. And so that was almost a new technology window around automobiles because the tech had changed again around batteries. And so he was basically saying like B2B SaaS has had a 20-year window and now AI software, AI starting in 2016. And that's like the current window that we're in. And I would say, you know, what Will is doing and what a lot of smart entrepreneurs are doing right now is they're in the technology window of AI, robotics, and 3D printing. And basically those three technologies have opened up the door to build new things that couldn't have been built 10, 15, 20 years ago. So this is what a technology window looks like. So just check this out. If you're on audio, you have to be on YouTube to see this, but I'm sharing my screen here. So it basically says like step one, the technology is invented and only the hobbyists are playing with it out of interest and creativity, right? And then two is the status moment. One of the hobbyists achieves status and wealth using the tech. So, you know, for example, so this is like, you know, Mark Andreessen on the cover of Time barefoot because the hobbyist internet guy became rich by building, you know, the browser. And then this happened again with social networking. This happened again with Elon and Palmer Luckey and all those guys right now who've had their status moment where, you know, Palmer was like literally like living in a RV building VR headsets for like $90 using spare parts. He was a hobbyist. And then the hobbyist got the wealth, the status moment when he sold to Facebook for $3 billion. And then, you know, same thing with Elon. Elon was building in relative obscurity, both OpenAI, you know, OpenAI was a nonprofit. It was relatively obscure for the first 5 years that it was out, that they were doing their thing. But now Sam Altman and Elon and Palmer again with Anduril have had a new status moment. And then there's what he calls knowledge diffusion, which is suddenly there's conferences, there's podcasts like this, there's newsletters, there's Twitter where people are sharing ideas about how to do this, what's going on, and you get this explosion of stuff. And then competition floods, and then the new incumbents are born. And the new incumbent regime takes over due to their defensibility. Like they build something that is defensible, maybe because it's hardware, maybe because it requires scale, maybe it has a network effect. And the technology window is 90% closed, and you'll only have a few exceptions from there on out.
All right, folks, this is a quick plug for a podcast called I Digress. If you're trying to grow your business but feel like you're drowning in buzzwords and BS, then check out the I Digress podcast. It's hosted by this guy named Troy Sandage. He's helped launch over 35 brands that drive $175 million in revenue. So if you want to get smarter about scaling your business, listen to I Digress wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the pod. It's so funny, Sean, and to meet Will, who's like in the thick of it, actually what you're describing.
Yeah. Will, when did you start? Were you a hobbyist? When did you start with doing what you're doing? Like, when were you messing around with drones or ocean tech?
So, yeah, I mean, as I said, I've been in the ocean, on the ocean, near the ocean since I was a kid, diving, surfing, whatever, wakeboarding, all these sorts of things growing up, but never had built in it really before this kind of scooter sharing startup thing popped off. I was working, in that. My co-founders all kind of had been tinkering and these sorts of things. But again, none of us had ever actually really done anything in the ocean, which I actually think is a massive benefit, right? Like, because none of us came in with these preconceived notions for how subsea drones should work. Two of my co-founders were building aerial drones in a drone delivery startup before. So they took a lot of the primitives from that. One of them had worked on self-driving cars, took some of the ideas from that. But again, I think there's definitely this idea that I agree with that, to really actually shake up an industry, it's probably good if you don't come from it, because we came to it and we thought initially that we were going to be maybe using someone else's platform and repurposing it. But we looked at all of the subsea drones on the market and they were crap. They cost one of the ones we were looking at, which actually had the specs that would have met what we wanted to do, cost $500,000. That's a quarter of our pre-seed to do what we want. Our CTO Jamie, he just went into a cave for a few days and just came back with a design for a new type of autonomous underwater vehicle. And then we tested and we're like, oh shit, this works. Oh shit, it's 10-20 times cheaper than anything we could have bought, so it's sometimes you just need a new idea and an autist to go into a cave, and then you can change things.
That's how all the great things, all the biggest problems have been solved.
This is all religions, Muhammad went into the cave, Jesus went into the desert, all these prophets, they go off into the old and they come back with this secret. And then, someone else spreads the word for them, right? St. Peter does it in the Catholic Church and others. So yes, this is a common archetype that, that does work. Yes.
you said something earlier about, how a billion people rely on the sea for their food. Has anybody done, food or tuna or salmon in a way? Are they doing anything interesting there with whether it's lab grown or something innovative?
Yeah. My friend's got a very, very interesting startup called Wild Type, which is sustainable sushi grade salmon. So basically that's cultivated seafood. So their first product,
what do you mean by cultivated?
It's grown. It's grown. It's not farmed in or caught at sea.
Grown in a lab or grown?
Exactly. In this industrial process. Yeah, they can basically grow cells and then put them together in such a way that it tastes like sashimi grade salmon. So, in the same way that Elon started off with a sports car, right? They're starting off with your sashimi grade salmon, the highest end salmon to get. And I've tried it. It's great.
This is in San Francisco. It looks like a brewery.
Yes, exactly. It's similar ideas. Breweries are where so much of the best kind of biotech innovation has come from people building mass industrial processes for cultivating food for a very long period of time. In fact,
so you're telling me that someone is growing salmon that I can go and eat right now?
Yeah. I mean, I got it through my friend. I don't know if they're in stores yet. They're still undergoing FDA approval. But none of these nasty heavy metals or microplastics in them. It's reducing pressure on fish stocks. This is good stuff. It doesn't have any of the nasty parasites that you get in some of this farmed salmon as well. Definitely. I think things like this will be important.
Holy shit.
This is crazy to me.
This is crazy.
Is it like the lab grown meats where it's like $10,000 an ounce. It's like, you either have the cheap thing like Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods, mm-hmm. but it doesn't taste great or it's not good for you. It's made with a bunch of chemicals, or you have the real thing, but it's super expensive. And so nobody can afford it.
Well, I think given that, like, my friend shared it with me, that it's not that expensive, but it's...
You're not that good of friends.
No, exactly. Yeah, are you? But I think this stuff is, like, sooner than we think. It's around the corner.
Wow, these guys did a $100 million Series B in 2022. That's pretty crazy.
What? What else is cool? Tell me everything. What the guys like you are into. Like, some more ocean shit.
Some crazy ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This one is wild, right? Buckle up. Okay. Ocean treasure hunting, right? So there is actually hundreds of wrecks out there in the ocean today that potentially have like more than $1 billion on them, right? Like gold bullions that like the Spanish were bringing back from their conquests and then, you know, they got hit by a storm or these sorts of things, right? And there's like probably thousands that have like millions of dollars of funds in them, right? So governments... the source governments, so like the Spaniards, the Portuguese, still have claim on these things. However, there is precedent in history for you to do these kind of like profit sharing agreements where it's like, if we find that and we restore, we give you back all your artifacts, we give you back everything, but you know, we sell some of them, can we keep some? So you can do this, right?
It's like these models where it's like these SaaS negotiation companies were like, hey, if we go and save you money on your vendors,
we get a cut.
We keep 20%. Yeah. It's that, except for you go to the Spanish royal government and you're like, hey, there are, if we find any hidden treasures in the ocean, can we keep a couple bars for ourselves?
Exactly. Ram for piracy. Who's building this?
So my friend used to do this. His name's Chip Forsyth. And he would be like, hey, I'm going off the coast of whatever to go.
Bro, you did not have a friend that used to do this. That's insane.
Chip Forsyth. You know,
he went off the coast and just scuba dive?
Well,
what was he doing?
It was Chip and AJ Forsyth, who I think you've met. AJ, he's crazy. His brother, Chip, they basically, the way it works now is, it's kind of like a movie. Like you have these crazy people and you get other people to finance it. And you say, if we find this treasure, you know, here's the agreement on how we split it. And they would go off the coast. They would somehow narrow in on where they think it is. They would spend a week trying to find it. And most of the time you don't find it, but occasionally you hit the lottery. Is that right, Will, how it works now?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. So there's like fundamentally two parts of like a mission. It's like, or three parts is like, there's like, you know, the pre-mission, you know, negotiating, or like, you know, looking to historical records to see like where we think it could be, you know, kind of scoping it out and also getting permission so that when you do the recovery, you have like some chance of being able to hold on to it. Then there's like this kind of scouting where you're actually on site and you're doing like scouting and you're like basically using sonar to scan the seabed and understand what's there. And then there's like recovery where you're bringing out these like gnarly like JCB style ROVs and remote operated vehicles that go down and just like dig it all up and bring it back up and you have your party.
And is anybody doing this? Like, do you know someone who's like made like $10 million finding treasures in the ocean?
I know some people working on this that haven't like shared their plans publicly yet, so I won't like share, but there is like some exciting developments coming in this space that we may or may not be helping with.
Did you say there's 3 million shipwrecks at the bottom of the ocean?
So I'm not sure specifically on like a total amount of shipwrecks. I wouldn't be surprised if there's like that many shipwrecks, but there's like hundreds that potentially have billions on them.
Wow.
Okay. That's insane. What else?
So I'll give you like a banger quote, right? There's this like Canadian billionaire called Russ who had this quote a few years ago. He said, give me a tanker of iron filings and I will give you an ice age. Right. What he meant by that is like you can actually alter like the kind of weather of the earth by like dunking iron into the ocean. Right. So basically like many, many parts of the ocean are low in iron. They need more iron. And if you add iron to these parts of the ocean, you stimulate like algae growing at the surface. Algae then draws down carbon and then the fish eat it and then the fish die and they fall to the bottom of the sea. And then so the carbon goes from the air into the bottom of the ocean, right? So this is like generally good because we have too much carbon in the atmosphere. We also want more fish, but you need to balance it because you don't want to put too much in and then just like there's too much salmon and then there's like salmon take over like the, you know, a certain like ecosystem, which is maybe like not good or something like that. Or, you know, there's a basically when you're doing stuff in like with ecosystems, it's very like difficult to predict how things are going to pan out. So you need to be careful. So this dude didn't do it that carefully. It went out like off the coast of like Vancouver, partnered up with these like Native Americans and just did like this experiment where he just like basically dumped off a load of iron filings, removed it, through his quantifications, like thousands of tons of carbon. They're off the coast there that year, they had like the biggest like take of salmon ever as a result. But the kind of desal authorities did not like his experimentation, and like the Canadians equivalent of like the CIA like busted his home, and he got like, yeah, like a warrant, and yeah, he got in a lot of trouble. So people haven't really done it since then, because he kind of got like, you know, he was the kind of first crazy, maybe like the first hobbyist to do something like this at scale. But I think there is going to be like a $1 billion company built in like marine geoengineering of some description. There's this, so I'm Catholic, so it's like there's this like a lot of my beliefs around like my environmentalism and stuff like that comes from like this Christian notion of stewardship, that like we should like look after our lands and our seas because it's like our duty to. And I think this is like kind of like where we're going with like how we manage the climate. Like climate used to be this kind of, let's like avoid the worst case scenario, and it was just very like kind of like, let's like stop emitting carbon. But like I think there's like a more interesting idea of like this like stewardship, I think, of environmentalism, where we actually just like control, you know, we steward the planet, right? We like, we take control, we get involved. We, you know, someone like Augustus at Rainmaker can make it rain when we want it to rain. You know, someone like Ulysses can come in and bring back the seagrasses when we need the seagrasses. You know, someone could, like, you know, when we want to draw down carbon, can do like, or increase fish stocks somewhere, we could just like do a bit of this. I think we're gonna have to build these tools, right? Because we need these in tandem with growing the size of the economic pie if we want to keep doing that. You know, we don't want to just like shut down the economy. We don't want to like just stop doing like emissions altogether. It's important for us to have these other kind of compensatory mechanisms. And yeah, I think marine geoengineering is like an interesting and like underexplored space. I think main things we need to get right there are science, better science on it, better technology, and the governance about it, because the ocean is like a public space. It's like, you know, you just need to get the governance part right.
Have you seen, Sean, have you seen this guy, Augustus, the founder of Rainmaker?
Incredible mullet. Yeah, oh my
dude,
God.
So
wow.
There's this whole cohort of people, of which Will appears to be one of the, like, you know, class presidents, where there's this, like, they're very strange. They don't fit this stereotype. When you think of a tech entrepreneur, they're like kind of manly men, or they're not like this engineer, like typical thing that you and I grew up with, Sean. Like there's something about them that is different. And I can't tell if you guys are going to take over the world and be billionaires, or if you're going to go broke, but it's only going to be one of the two. Do you understand, Sean, like this new genre that I'm trying to describe? I don't know exactly what I'm saying, Will. Maybe you can like put words to it, but there's this new like breed that I...
Austin and San Francisco had a baby. You get the stash and the mullet of Austin, and then you get the insane ambition and tech chops of Silicon Valley, and that's what's happening.
For
here.
Example, this guy Augustus, I think his name is, he's on the cover, I think, of Forbes or something, and he's sitting on a bench press, like working out. That is not something that Brian Chesky or you know, Travis Kalanick would have done in 2012.
I think it's emblematic of like of kind of the evolution of the technology industry, though. I think, like, you know, we began like as this kind of like hippies that found computers, with people like Steve Jobs. We were like actualizing on like the axis of like the spiritual, you know, realm. And then it was like, you know, you had like people like Bill Gates and Zuckerberg, who were just like nerds, like actualizing on the sense of like mind. You know, they were like smart and nerdy. And now you have like people who are like openly flexing on like, we're actualizing on the sense of the body, right? Like we're like becoming strong. And like you have like this like full integration of like mind, body, and spirit. And it's like no wonder that this like tech becoming like fully actualized on all of the axes that like that a human needs to develop on is happening at the exact same time where you have like Elon, who is like chief tech bro in the fucking White House, right? Like these things, this is like no coincidence to me. It's like tech has like found its voice. It's like found itself. It's like self-confident, and it's like ready to like actually change the world now, because it's like, it's, you know, it's like spiritually like aligned. It's like mentally there, you know, we're smart, and like we're like now like a strong group of people as well, who are taking health and fitness seriously. And it's like, yeah, so this is why I think like we're at like the most interesting time in technology right now.
I like that. Poetic. You know, last night I watched a clip of the final scene of Ratatouille. You seen that, Sam?
No.
It's a great movie. And the final scene of Ratatouille is the critic the critic who's the most fearsome critic in all of the town writes the review about the restaurant where the rat has been cooking, and he just gives this beautiful monologue. Maybe the most beautiful 4 minutes in all of film is the last 4 minutes of Ratatouille here, the monologue. Will, I think you're up there with the last 4 minutes of Ratatouille there with your mind, body, and spirit analogy for tech. I think that's kind of amazing. I've actually heard that before with just the technology part of it. So it's like you had the initial, you know, the bicycle for the mind. So you had Steve Jobs talking about how computers will enable creativity. And then you had, you know, sort of AI. It's like, oh, we gave computers a brain and now they can think for themselves. And then with robotics and self-driving cars, it's like we gave the computers a body so they can move around and pick up things and do things. And I like how you you extended that to you know, the entrepreneurial will has grown in that way.
Look at Bezos and Zuckerberg, they're getting jacked. Like, they're doing TRT. They look like, this is like, I think
that's true.
Emblematic of like the spirit is in technology now. It's like, you have the, like, you know, one of my favorite podcasts besides yours, you know, the Tech Bros and like what Jordy and John are doing there. It's like, they're the technology brothers. They're like leaning into the fact that they're like tech bros. That used to be a slur, right? Now it's like, oh, I'm confident in it. I'm like, I'm owning it. And they're like doing these like hilarious promo videos of them like sipping Dom Perignon. Like, it's like, there's like a confidence and an air of like, okay, let's do it now. You know, we're not going to be like at like the events and functions anymore, kind of lying about what
you're
doing.
Not neutered.
Dude, listen to this. Yourself. I got an email from this guy named Jamie at the Wall Street Journal. So Jamie is a reporter for Wall Street Journal's style team. And he, listen to this. He goes, I'm writing a story about tech guys embracing Western wear, so basically cowboy clothes, in the past recent years. And I want to write about how the tech bro uniform has changed from quarter zips and Allbirds to denim shirts, cowboy boots. And like when I saw this and he said tech bro, I was like,
dude, that's amazing.
I was like, I don't think I could talk. Like, this is not going
to
be.
Also, life win that he thinks you're the expert to go to, right?
Yeah, life win. But I was like, I'm not exactly in tech, but that's amazing that you think that I am a fashion influencer officially. No. Yeah.
reply, mission accomplished.
Yeah.
Dude, that's amazing. And you're right. Like, dude, is there any difference? You know, the first time you saw Zuck doing MMA, do you remember when that video came out? Is there any difference between that video and the first time you saw like a Boston Robotics or Boston Dynamics robot dog getting kicked and like jumping around and like doing backflips and shit? Like, there's no difference between the two videos.
Yeah.
That's the same video.
It's one of those
to me.
Days that everyone remembers where they were when they saw it.
It's like, wow, I didn't know the robots could do that. That's how I felt watching Zuck. That's how I felt watching the Boston Dynamics robot.
Well, one lot of last questions. Can I invest?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay, cool. Because I think this is awesome. You guys are insane, man. This energy is so wild. I'm not convinced that it's going to end one. Like, okay, so on one hand, it goes both ways. So on one hand, there's the hubris where, you know, you're like a, you know, in the case of Anduril, you're Boeing or you're one of these huge companies and you're like, you know, Parker or Palmer, you know nothing. You know, just go back to...
It would be better if they called him Parker.
Parker,
more
sorry.
Condescending.
Little Parker.
Listen, Parker.
They would be like, Palmer, you know nothing. You know, you're just... You go back to making Facebook apps, you know. And like, probably 8 out of 10 times, that idea is right? Where like, there's an incumbent and like, they fail because it's really hard and there's centuries of hard work to go against and competition. And so that's the same with you, and I would have to imagine, where you have these young, really smart people who have no experience. And is this the 10% of the time where you guys are just going to take over the world? Or is this another time where someone's going to be like, look, this is exactly what you told you. It does not work.
All right, listen, that guy, John, that guy who said, give me half a tanker of iron and I will give you an ice age. Here's what I say. Give me 100 mullets and I'll give you a 10x portfolio. I just need Will. I need Augustus. I need Palmer with a mullet, right? 3 mullets. I need 97 more mullets and I'll give you a 10x return.
Okay. Give me the fund. I'll find the mullet for you.
You find the mullet.
Like, I don't know enough to know if this is achievable or not.
Oh, I definitely understand that feeling. Yeah, for sure. I'm not qualified to judge the feasibility of something. But I think in general, it's not about any, you know, if anybody who's doing a startup like this thinks it's a sure thing or a sure bet, you're nuts, right? Like,
right.
You're going to have to perform a miracle, right? And that's okay. The important thing is, oh, wow, we took a portion of our brain power that was otherwise going to be building X or working at Y company, you know, working at Facebook, optimizing, you know, ad clicks, or starting a company that was going to be doing, you know, B2B HR or whatever software. And instead, now we peeled off a portion of that talent. And now we sent, you know, 100 mullets at these problems. And I think that's the winning strategy, is 100 or 1,000 shots on goal like this. And then the winners will obviously emerge. Mm-hmm.
Well, I can assure you what we're doing is very real. You wouldn't have $1 million in our bank account without it. We wouldn't have done all the things we've done in the last 5 months. If you want to come here to San Francisco and see some real robots in Ocean, the door is always open, Sam. Same for you, Shan.
I got to ask you two quick questions. Number one, Seagrass seems so random. And if you started this company, you might have thought, oh, I'll do drones like for warfare.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at the Seagrass thing? Was it instant? Was that the initial idea? Yeah. Or did you do some discovery to figure that out?
It was the initial idea. I came to one of my co-founders when he was on a surf trip, and he kind of, the same ones who went into the cave and designed our AUV, heard about Seagrass and went into a cave and like went deep on Seagrass and came back to us and presented like, this is a very interesting space. And we kind of put
He heard about Seagrass on a surf trip from who?
A marine biologist friend of his who was working
just
on
a guy out in the wave.
Yeah.
Dude, this co-founder is absolutely carrying your company.
Yeah.
This guy who built the tech and figured out the go-to-market. I love it.
Yeah, he's the, he was the one who brought Seagrass to us. And then myself and my other co-founders kind of put it together. And like, this is what the business probably should look like. But then, yeah, we kind of went out from there into other areas. And like, you know, like I think any brilliant company finds a local monopoly to build in first, somewhere where there's nobody else doing stuff with technology, where it's a great time and nobody's ever heard of what you're even doing initially. And it's a pretty big market. You can, bring cash into your business as like a lifeblood. And so it's been a great place for us to start. It's like the best place for us to start. Nobody's ever heard of it. So I think that's always a good place to start off on. And then, yes, we're going to use that as a kind of launching point to do other interesting things in the ocean.
Who do you admire, Will? Who do you want to be like?
Steve Irwin, probably.
Dude, motherfucker. I was going to say this earlier on. I go, you are Steve Irwin. Yeah. I knew you got C vibes. Hardcore, man. Do you got any khaki shorts on right now?
Not right now, but we have a picture of him up on the wall here.
Yeah. Oh, you scream Steve Irwin. You have Steve Irwin vibes through and through.
Yeah. No, he's... I'm hopeful I can... I get the Irwin family on the Ulysses train at some point.
We gotta holler at Bindi Irwin.
That would be great. Robert Bindi's as well.
I love those guys.
Yeah, Robert as well. Look, Steve, I think is like, and it's so funny. People say Steve on a podcast in the tech, it's like Steve Jobs. It's like for me, it's like Steve Irwin.
You should have just said Steve at the beginning and then let us fall into your trap.
Dude, Sean, there's this famous video. I know you've seen this, Will. There's this famous video of it's Steve Irwin and his wife. What's her name? I forget her name. And anyway, there's an interviewer who asked Steve, like, you don't seem like you care.
Sam. Just look what's on my screen. Just look what's on my screen right now.
Oh, there it is. Thank you.
Just look what I was pulling up because
I love that clip.
With you, brother. I love this clip.
I love this clip. Play it.
What good is a fast car, a flash house, and a gold plated dunny to me? Absolutely no good at all. I've been put on this planet to protect wildlife and wilderness areas, which in essence is going to help humanity. I want to have the purest oceans. I want to be able to drink water straight out of that creek. I want to stop the ozone layer. I want to save the world. And you know, money's great. I can't get enough money. And you know what I'm going to do with it? I'm going to buy wilderness areas with it. Every single cent I get goes straight into conservation. And guess what, Charles? I don't give a rip whose money it is, mate. I'll use it and I'll spend it on buying land.
This is how every man should be, by the way. Like, you're passionate about something that's good for others. And like, his wife's just like eyeing him. And that's one of my favorite clips of all time.
Yeah, it's I think the traits in him that I admire is just like this raw passion. It's like this unbridled passion. It's like this nonsensical passion. It's like
You think I'm going to have a conversation without a microphone? No, I'm going to put a microphone there. I'm going to record a podcast. I'm going to record a podcast every day. And I don't give a rip who's listening. Because you know what? I'm a podcaster. And I'm going to podcast my ass off.
It's a whole lot more lame, but you're not talking about like saving the earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I
know. Like,
I tried.
Like when we're talking about like conversion rate optimization or B2B. Dude, in fact, Will, we kind of, my generation and the generation before me, we you know, what do they say? Hard times create, or no, like we need a hard men to create soft times. That's what I did for you. You know, we went and did the B2B software stuff so you guys could do this fun, amazing stuff. So really, you're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
New York City founders, if you've listened to My First Million before, you know I've got this company called Hampton. And Hampton is a community for founders and CEOs. A lot of the stories and ideas that I get for this podcast, I actually got it from people who I met in Hampton. We have this big community of 1,000+ people, and it's amazing. But the main part is this 8-person core group that becomes your board of advisors for your life and for your business, and it's life-changing. Now, to the folks in New York City, I'm building a in real life core group in New York City. And so if you meet one of the following criteria, your business either does $3 million in revenue, or you've raised $3 million in funding, or you've started and sold a company for at least $10 million, then you are eligible to apply. So go to joinhampton.com and apply. I'm going to be reviewing all of the applications myself. So put that you heard about this on MFM so I know to give you a little extra love. Now back to the show.
Can we do just a quick happy hour of two topics that you had on this list that, I, you know, Sam, if you got to run or whatever, feel free. But I just got to ask you about these. So I want to do the fun one and then the spiritual one. The fun one is conspiracy theories. You're a big conspiracy. You're a fan of conspiracy theories, I believe. And you like people who like conspiracy theories. So can you just give me a rant on why conspiracy theories are underrated here?
I think, I think it's like, you know, a lot of the traits of like conspiracy theorists are like those of like a great, like a founder. I think like someone that like believes in something that everyone else tells them is like not real, or like, you know, that they shouldn't believe in, or like, you know, people that are like able to see patterns that others can't see. And, you know, they just like go down these like rabbit holes. I think like just like this contrarian spirit, I think is like very, very good. And I think it's just like a very important, you know, the default is like doing things that other people do. And so I think it's very important to cultivate an ability to see the world differently, I think.
Isn't it funny how contrarian is this like really positive description and conspiracy theorist is like this like negative description, you know what I mean? It's the same thing.
I just think it's very important to, you know, have weird ideas and take them seriously, right? Like if we just had heard the seagrass idea and just like rubbished it, you know, we wouldn't, I would like, I don't know what the hell I'd be doing today. You know, it's like you need to take something weird and go with it. So like, I don't believe, like, to blindly believe every report of telepathy and nonverbal autistic children, every like late night UFO sighting, but like I refuse to dismiss them outright. And I think, you know, history shows us that breakthroughs often happen at the edges where people are curious enough or foolhardy enough to investigate the unexplainable. So it's like, whether it's like Christian mystics, you know, who swear by miraculous healings, or physics experiments that like challenge our understanding of space-time, I think it's very important to like lean into these weird things and ask what if. And yeah, I think conspiracy theories are just kind of like fun as well. They're like kind of like horoscopes for dudes. So they're like, if nothing else, like they're just like, it's just like a fun thing to kind of like spend your time reading about.
On here, you talk about aliens. We were with Joe Gebbia recently, who's like the 90th richest person in the world. And I was like, Joe, look, you're worth like $10 billion. Like if there's Illuminati, like you are either in it or you're friends with the people in it. Tell me one thing that like you guys talk about. And he looked at me, he goes, aliens are real. And he had a big diatribe on his passion for like, you know, UFOs and aliens and how he absolutely is on board with them.
100%.
Is on board with them?
He came off very passionately. Like it is absolutely a thing.
And the funny thing is if you meet Joe, he's a serious dude. Joe doesn't just say wild shit for wild shit's sake. You know, Joe's not like, oh, he's a kooky billionaire. No, no, no. Joe is like an extremely principled artist. He is a very serious individual. And so for him to say something like that, it's not like you don't discount it with the same discount rate you would if John McAfee was the guy saying it. You know what I mean?
If your reader's wandering down this rabbit hole, the best website I recommend going is a website a friend of mine runs, uapevidence.com.
Is there any other dope conspiracy that I should go look into, a rabbit hole that would waste a nice 5 hours of my time?
I think
less of a conspiracy, more like wacky, weird rabbit hole you need to go down, is you need to listen to the Telepathy Tapes podcast.
I have, and I love them.
What's okay. What is this? Is this like I can read your mind?
So basically, there's this group of people that people have been calling crazy for like the last like 2 decades, right? It's basically the teachers and parents of children with nonverbal autism, because they've been convinced that their kids have been able to like read their mind. And now for like the first time with teaching kids how to spell on like iPads, and also with like getting researchers in to study them, they're actually verifying these telepathic capabilities, right? So like a mother will like go into one room and she'll be shown like a random number generator, and her son Akil in the other room will hit the exact same 3 numbers 100% of the time consistently in tests.
That's awesome.
Yes,
it's like the Serial podcast, but it's this woman investigating these claims, and she's like, you know, like an NPR skeptical, let me call it, right? So she comes in, she's like, this didn't make a ton of sense, but I'm open-minded.
Is she turned?
I didn't finish the whole thing. I listened probably the first 2 or 3, but I was listening to it while I was going to sleep, and I just had some like wild nights there. So I decided, all right, I need to only listen to this, you know, not falling asleep if I'm going to do this right. But by the way, Will, did you walk away from that, you know, half convinced, 3/4 convinced, totally convinced? What did you walk away?
Well, I was going into it already with some sort of like priors that I thought that like consciousness isn't local to the brain. Like we like to think that like our brain is this kind of like DVD player where like consciousness is playing and it's like being played to us, and that's how we experience things. I think we're more like, I always kind of thought, and for different reasons, that we're more like a radio antenna. You know, you have these stories of people like their son dies in an accident and they just know something's wrong, right? They just like know, right? Like there's like the, you know, every family has these stories of like death or like something bad happened, and they just like knew. They woke up in the middle of the night and they're like, I couldn't sleep then after that. And then they wake up the next day, they hear about this awful accident or something like that. Or you have like this like knowingness and these other things, like just like telepathy, twins telepathy and stuff like that. And there's like this world of parapsychology, which is like the study of these kind of psi phenomena. There's like actually very reproducible experiments in it, like the Ganzfeld experiment, which, if you allow me to go on this like very short rabbit hole, but like the most reproducible experiment in this field is basically you take 2 people, you put them in like 2 separate rooms. These could be twins, these could be husband, wife, they could be 2 artists, they could be 2 people who don't know each other, different settings. And basically you give me a picture and you give, and you're the receiver then in another room. And I'm in one room and I'm talking about this random picture I've been given. Let's say it's 1 in 4 different pictures. I get a picture of an elephant. For 5 minutes, I talk about elephants. I saturate my brain with Africa and wild animals and savanna. You're in the other room, you're listening to white noise, and you're talking basically about what you're sensing, feeling that they could be about. And then at the end of the 5 minutes, I stop and you get replayed what you were saying to yourself for 5 minutes, and you get the 4 random images and you get to pick 1 of the 4. And then you would assume, if complete chance, you know, you would 25% chance of getting it right, but pretty consistently you get like 30% or above in this like experiment. And then when there's like twins, husband and wives, and or artists, they actually score like more consistently, 35, in some instances like 70% in some of these experiments. And so I've always kind of been like primed to think that like actually maybe we're more like, we're touching into something, and like that explains a lot of the spiritual and woo-woo stuff. And then I see this, and it's like very good experimental evidence and really well done, and I'm like, okay, nah, that's 100% legit. Like our brain is not like this like AI chip that like runs and just like tells us what to do. It's like an AI chip, but it's like, it also has a radio antenna that can connect to other people, can maybe connect to God, spirits, other things. We don't really know.
Dude, I'm so bummed that I grew up in the B2B era of startups. Yeah, it's so bummed. Well, I wish we, like, I wish I was 10 years younger. You were 10. I wish we could have hung out.
Dude, let's grab some beers.
I went to a bachelor party this weekend, and everybody on it was a bachelor party where the bachelors and the bachelorettes were both at doing it together, basically, as a party together. And the bachelorette side was so cool. Like, every single one of them, just, you know, those tattoos that aren't like filled in, they're just like, it almost looks like a pencil sketch.
Yeah.
Just 7 or 8 of those, some piercings, sense of style off the charts, knowledge of beer and music way beyond my recognition. You know, sexuality was a total spectrum. You never knew who's dating who. Anybody could be dating anybody in the room. It was insane. I just felt like, I literally felt like I was a caveman, and I was like, or like, you know, like I was the gingerbread man, actually. I wasn't even a real human being. I was a cookie cutter shape that was placed in this room.
That's awesome. That is so funny.
I think one like universal law about technology is that like it breeds variance, right? Like it just like it creates like skewed outcomes. And I think you probably like see this in like younger generations as well. Like you've got like weird, like kind of like schizo people like me that will like burn your ear off by like conspiracy theories and like, you know, go down like these weird rabbit holes. But like, I think you also, it's like on the, like maybe on the more negative end, that could send you like down like some pretty dark places that maybe you wouldn't be a productive member of society if you go down like those, like into those like very dark corners of the internet. Or similarly, like it's, you know, you have people who are like doing like great things, but then you also like, you know, I think there is like a very interesting question that's posed in technology right now is like, you know, where are the, you know, the kind of like less than kind of 25, billion-dollar company founders. This is like an interesting question that I think is still not really like, there's no satisfying answers around. Like previous generations had like the Collisons pretty early. You know, we had like Alexander Wang, like who's maybe like a few years older than me, pretty early. Still doesn't seem clear why there isn't one in this generation. Maybe we have to wait another year or two for companies like Ulysses or Rainmaker or others to like to get there. But there is definitely like a, I think, a bigger skew in both the ideas that young people are interested in today. I think that's like broadly just like downstream of technology.
Are you going to become an American?
I think I'm going to get, I'm on the green card path. Yeah.
My last question was the spiritual one. You said you lived with Buddhist monks in Nepal and for a summer, you learned a lot. And one thing I liked, you said, I couldn't come around to their view, which states that zero desires leads to enlightenment. And then you said you wanted to be action oriented and do something with your life rather than sit and sort of renounce everything. And then you said something like, I came to explain my five desires or six desires. Can you just give me the quick story on your summer with the monks and then what you landed at?
Yeah. So yeah, I just, I just had heard that you could do this, right? You can actually just like find a monastery to like basically put you up if you teach them English. So I did that, found a monastery in Nepal that would like put me up. It's pretty rural, a few hours outside Kathmandu. Went there, flew there, taught myself to teach English before, came over, was teaching them English. And then like in the downtime was like able to speak to some of the older monks who had like good English and like ask them about their ideology. Cause
there's just five monks with like a thick Irish accent speaking English out there. They're like, yeah, I learned from an expert.
Wild actual segue. I was out running in the middle of Nepal one day and I bumped into a dude who was wearing a Galway Bay 5K t-shirt. And I was like, Sarina, you might have like no English, but I was like, where did you get this like t-shirt? Like, this is like, we're near where I'm from. And he was like, had like kind of like an Irish accent. He's like, oh, well, you know, I actually work with an Irish guy. He has like an orphanage and like a charity out here. And I was like, oh, wait, like, what's this like Irish guy's name? The Irish guy he named was like the one Irish guy that my neighbor, who's like my mom's friend was like, my mom was worried about me going to Nepal. She was like, well, you know, you need to have a contact in Nepal when you go over there. You know, I was like, and it's in my neighbor knew a guy who's in Nepal who had a charity out there. Anyway, like this random guy I met in this like tiny village worked with him. So this is like, you know, there's like Irish people everywhere.
Everyone just talking like kind of like all these monks are like a little bit kind of, I boxed them.
They're like, you'll do nothing.
I boxed the bullocks off them. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll do nothing, literally.
There's Irish people everywhere. We have people everywhere. That's like the kind of moral.
Is that what the monks are saying? We didn't come to take part. We came to take over.
All right. So sorry. So you go there and you're, continue.
I'm curious about the religion. I'm asking questions about it. But one thing I just couldn't get over was like, you know, they don't believe in desire. Like they believe desire is like what leads to suffering. If you desire for something, then you're creating a contract with yourself to be unhappy until you have that thing. And I'm just like, dude, I'm very like American dream pilled. I'm like, you know, I should want for things. But I can see how that can go wrong as well, right? Because that leads to like, you know, keeping up with the Joneses type lifestyle, or maybe like, you know, kind of like, the, you know, the fatties on the chair at Walmart kind of like thing. You know, like that's like probably like when it goes like maybe like too far.
So, hey, you better watch it, Will.
That's our demo. Yeah.
You better watch what you're saying.
No, sorry. You're not that fat, Sam. So that's why I can see where it can go wrong, right? But I do think there was like an essence of truth in there where it's like maybe you should like actually try to trim down things as little as possible. And I had this like
bizarre experience where I went and did Everest Base Camp afterwards, and I was thinking a lot about like the things that they were saying to me. And again, I feel like I had like a download, like one of these experiences where like something just came into my brain that I don't think I hadn't been thinking about it before. And I genuinely think it was a download from, you know, something spiritual that like gave me like some guidance on how I was literally, it sounds crazy, but I was sitting on a rock, like just like on a break in the hike, this like 10-day hike up to a base camp. And I was thinking through, it's like, okay, well, if you have no desire, like what do you do? It's like, oh, maybe you should have desire, but the minimum amount of them. Then I was like, what is like important to me? And I was like, on my hand, I was like, oh, my family, my friends, my health, my wealth, my craft. And I was like, oh shit, like that's like five things. That's like nice and clean. And then I like had this like idea at the same time of like a rose bush. Like rose bushes, if you like leave them go unkept, they basically just grow like briars and they go thorns and the flowers don't really grow. You have to like cut them back to let the energy go back to like the rose. And I was just like, I had this like very clear vision of like roses, and I was like, oh, okay, right. So this is it. Okay. So whenever I'm like down over something, it's like, if it's not one of these like five important things to me, then it's like, okay, just like let it go. Like stop desiring for it. And I found that to be helpful.
You had a girlfriend?
No.
That was your reaction to his story about the Buddhist monks and like realizing the meaning of life.
You want to, dude, you tell me an Irish guy with that in his Tinder profile, is he just going to destroy the whole city? Give me a break.
Saving the world, seagrass, former monk, Sam's five desires, family, health, wealth, fitness, and will. Those are Sam's five desires.
This is so good, right, man. You're the best.
Will, this is awesome. People should check you out. Where on Twitter? You're Will O'Brien. What's your handle?
At Will O'Brien, WILOBRI.
Okay, great. And good luck with the company, man.
Thank you, dude. Thank
you. All right, that's it. That's the pod. Thank you.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back.
Hey everyone, a quick break. My favorite podcast guest on My First Million is Dharmesh. Dharmesh founded HubSpot. He's a billionaire. He's one of my favorite entrepreneurs on earth. And on one of our podcasts recently, he said the most valuable skill that anyone could have when it comes to making money in business is copywriting. And when I say copywriting, what I mean is writing words that get people to take action. And I agree, by the way. I learned how to be a copywriter in my 20s. It completely changed my life. I ended up starting and selling a company for tens of millions of dollars, and copywriting was the skill that made all of that happen. And the way that I learned how to copywrite is by using a technique called copy work, which is basically taking the best sales letters and I would write it word for word, and I would make notes as to why each phrase was impactful and effective. And a lot of people have been asking me about copy work, so I decided to make a whole program for it. It's called Copy That. CopyThat.com. It's only like $120, and it's a simple, fast, easy way to improve your copywriting. And so if you're interested, you need to check it out. It's called Copy That. You can check it out at CopyThat.com.